or cartoons we had been studying in history class. Gross exaggerations that led to world wars. I wondered what sort of companies manufactured targets like this, because they sure as hell weren't being sold in places like Walmart's hunting aisle. It was as if there was a whole secret society I'd never known about, and I'd just been whispered the password for admission. I snagged a target with a bushy afro bursting through the borders of the bullseye. The man affixed it to a clothesline.
"Can't even tell it's a silhouette," he said with a snicker.
He put meat on the table to sniff at the targets as he zipped mine back to the edge of the stump pile.
"You know how to handle a weapon?" he asked.
I'd taken shots with my grandpa's handgun, but I'd never used anything like this. I listened to the man explain how the gun worked, then I put on the headphones and goggles for protection, tucked the stock against my shoulder, squinted, and squeezed the trigger. There was a volley of shots like a coughing fit. The sound drew Rain's attention, and he clapped, impressed, as the target zipped back to me with three clean shots in the forehead.
"Look at you," he said. "A natural."
Rain folded the target and tucked it into his back pocket so he could show his friends later how good a marksman I was. I took Meat's leash again and we walked across the meeting grounds. On the stage, a man was grandstanding. His presence was so commanding that his voice became a magnet, and I found myself being pulled to see him more clearly.
"I want to tell you all a little story," the man said. "There was a nigger in New York City. Homeless, of course. He was walking through Central Park and several people heard him ranting, saying that he would punch a white man in his sleep. But these people, they didn't realize we are fighting a war, that we are protecting our race. So they did not act. They ignored the threats as the raving of a crazy fool. And what happened? This beast of the field approached a white Anglo, a man like you, maybe, or me, who was doing nothing but living the life God intended him to live, a man who cared for his 90-year-old mother. This beast of the field punched this man, who fell down, struck his head on the pavement, and died. This white man, who had only been taking a walk in the park, suffered a fatal injury. Yet I ask you, what happened to the nigger? Well, my brothers and sisters, absolutely nothing."
I thought of my brother's killer, walking free out of a courtroom. I watched the people around me nod and clap and thought, I am not alone. "Who is he?" I asked.
"Francis Mitchum," Rain murmured. "He's one of the old guard, but he's like mythic."
He said the speaker's name the way a pious man spoke of God, part whisper, part prayer.
"You see the spider web on his elbow? You can't get that tat until you've killed someone. For every kill, you get a fly inked."
Rain paused.
"Mitchum? He's got 10.
"Why do niggers never get charged with hate crimes?"
Francis Mitchum asked, a rhetorical question.
"Why are they being given a free pass? They would not even be domesticated if not for the help of whites. Look at where they came from in Africa. There's no civilized government. They're all murdering each other in the Sudan. The Hutus are killing the Tutsis. And they're doing it in our country, too. The gangs in our cities, that's just tribal warfare among niggers. And now they're coming after Anglos because they know they can get away with it."
His voice rose as he looked out at the crowd.
"Killing a nigger is equal to killing a deer."
Then he paused.
"Actually, I take that back. At least you can eat venison."
Many years later, I realized that the first time I went to Invisible Empire Camp, the first time I heard Francis Mitchum speak, Britt must have been there too, traveling with her father. I like to think that maybe she was standing on the other side of that stage, listening to him hypnotize the crowd. That maybe we had bumped into each other at the cotton candy stand, or stood side by side when sparks from the cross lighting shot into the night sky. That we were meant to be. For an hour, Britt and I toss out names like baseball pitches, Robert, Ajax, Will, Garth, Eric, Odin. Every time I think I've come up with something strong and Aryan, Britt remembers a kid in her class with that name who ate paste or who threw up in his tuba. Every time she suggests a name she likes, it reminds me of some asshole I've crossed paths with. When it finally comes to me, with the subtlety of a lightning strike, I look down into my son's sleeping face and whisper it. Davis. The last name of the President of the Confederacy. Britt turns the word over in her mouth. It's different. Different is good. Davis, but not Jefferson, she clarifies. No, because then he'll be Jeff. And Jeff's a guy who smokes dope and lives in his mother's basement, Britt adds. But Davis, I say. Well, Davis is the kid other kids look up to. Not Dave, or Davy, or David. He'll beat up anyone who calls him that by mistake, I promise. I touch the edge of the baby's blanket, because I don't want to wake him. Davis, I say, testing it. His tiny hands flare, like he already knows his name. We should celebrate, Britt whispers. I smile down at her. You think they sell champagne in the cafeteria? You know what I really want? A chocolate milkshake. I thought the cravings were supposed to happen before the birth. She laughs. I'm pretty sure I get to play the hormone card for at least another 3 months. I get to my feet, wondering if the cafeteria is even open at 4 a.m. But I don't really want to leave. I mean, Davis just got here. What if I miss something? I ask. You know, like a milestone. It's not like he's going to get up and walk or say his first word, Britt answers. If you miss anything, it's going to be his first poop, and actually that's something you want to avoid. She looks up at me with those blue eyes that are sometimes as dark as the sea, and sometimes as pale as glass, and that always can get me to do anything. It's just 5 minutes, she says. 5 minutes. I look at the baby one more time, feeling like my boots are stuck in pitch. I want to stay here and count his fingers again, and those impossibly tiny nails. I want to watch his shoulders rise and fall as he breathes. I want to see his lips purse up like he's kissing someone in his dreams. It's crazy to look at him, flesh and blood, and know that Britt and I were able to build something real and solid out of a material as blurry and intangible as love. Whipped cream and a cherry, Britt adds, breaking my reverie. If they've got it. Reluctantly, I slip into the hallway past the nurse's station, down an elevator. The cafeteria is open, staffed by a woman in a hairnet who is doing a word search puzzle. Do you sell milkshakes? I ask. She glances up. Nope. How about ice cream? Yeah, but we're out. Delivery truck comes in the morning. She doesn't seem inclined to help me, and focuses her attention on her puzzle again. I just had a baby, I blurt out. Wow, she says flatly. A medical miracle on my very own checkout line. Well, my wife had a baby, I correct, and she wants a milkshake. I want a winning lottery ticket and Benedict Cumberbatch's undying love, but I had to settle for this glamorous life instead. She looks at me as if I'm wasting her time, as if there are 100 people waiting in line behind me. You want my advice? Get her candy. Everyone likes chocolate. She reaches blindly behind her and pulls down a box of Ghirardelli squares. I flip it over, scanning the label. Is that all you have? The Ghirardellis are on sale. I flip it over and see the OU symbol, the mark that proves it's kosher, that you're paying the Jewish mafia a tax. I put it back on the shelf and set a pack of Skittles down on the counter instead, with $2. You can keep the change, I tell her. Just after 7, the door opens, and just like that, I'm on full alert. Since Davis arrived, Lucille's been in twice. To check on Britt and the baby and to see how he was nursing. But this isn't Lucille. I'm Ruth, she announces. I'm going to be your nurse today.
All I can think is, over my dead body. It takes every ounce of willpower for me to not shove her away from my wife, my son. But security is only a buzzer away, and if they throw me out of the hospital, what good does that do us? If I can't be here to protect my family, then I've already lost. So instead, I perch on the edge of the chair, every muscle in my body poised to react. Britt grabs Davis so tightly I think he's going to start screaming.
Isn't he a sweetie? The black nurse says. What's his name?
My wife looks at me, a question in her eyes. She doesn't want to have a conversation with this nurse any more than she'd have a conversation with a goat or any other animal. But like me, she's aware that whites have become the minority in this country, and that we're always under attack. We have to blend in. I jerk my chin once, so infinitesimally I wonder if Britt will even see it.
His name is Davis, she says tightly.
The nurse moves closer to us, saying something about examining Davis, and Britt recoils.
You don't have to let go of him, she concedes.
Her hands start moving over my son like some kind of crazy witch doctor. She presses the stethoscope against his back and then in the space between him and Britt. She says something about Davis's heart, and I can barely even hear it because of the blood rushing in my own ears. Then she picks him up. Britt and I are so shocked that she just took our baby away, just over to the warmer for a bath, but still, that for a beat neither of us can speak. I take a step toward her, where she's bent over my boy, but Britt grabs the tail of my shirt.
Don't make a scene. Am I supposed to just stand here? Do you want her to know you're pissed off and take it out on him? I want Lucille back. What happened to Lucille? I don't know. Maybe she left. How can she do that when her patient is still here? I have no idea, Turk. I don't run this hospital.
I watch the black nurse like a hawk while she wipes Davis down and washes his hair and wraps him up in a blanket again. She puts a little electronic bracelet on his ankle, like the ones you sometimes see on prisoners who have been released on probation, as if he's already being punished by the system. I am staring so hard at the black nurse that I wouldn't be surprised if she goes up in flames. She smiles at me, but it doesn't quite reach her eyes.
Clean as a whistle, she announces. Now, let's see if we can get him to nurse.
She goes to pull aside the neck of Britt's hospital Johnny, and I'm done. Get away from her, I say, my voice low and true as an arrow. I want to talk to your boss. A year after I went to Invisible Empire Camp, Rain asked me if I'd like to be part of the North American Death Squad. It was not enough to just believe what Rain believed in about whites being a master race. It was not enough to have read Mein Kampf 3 times. To be one of them, truly, I had to prove myself. And Rain promised me I'd know where and when the right moment came to pass. One night when I was staying at my dad's, I woke up to hear banging on my bedroom window. I wasn't really worried about them waking up the household. My father was out at a business dinner in Boston, not due back till after midnight. As soon as I threw up the sash, Rain and 2 of the guys spilled inside, dressed in ninja black. Rain immediately tackled me onto the floor, forearm against my throat.
Rule number 1, he said, don't open the door if you don't know who's going to come inside.
He waited until I was seeing stars and then let me go.
Rule number 2, take no prisoners.
I don't understand, I said.
Tonight, Turk, he told me, we are custodians. We are going to clean Vermont of its filth.
I found a pair of black sweats and a screen-printed sweatshirt I wore inside out so that it was black, too. Since I didn't have a black knit cap, Rain let me wear his, and he pulled his hair back in a ponytail. We drove in Rain's car, passing a bottle of Jägermeister back and forth and blasting punk through the speakers, to Dummerston. I hadn't heard of the Rainbow Cattle Company, but as soon as we got there, I understood what kind of place this was. There were men holding hands as they walked from the parking lot into the bar,
and every time the door opened there was a flash of a brightly lit stage and a drag queen lip-syncing.
"Whatever you do, don't bend down," Rain told me and snickered.
"What are we doing here?"
I asked, not sure why he'd drag me to a gay bar. Just then two men walked out, their arms slung around each other.
"This," Rain said,
and he jumped on one of the guys, slamming his head against the ground. His date started to run in the other direction but was tackled by one of Rain's friends. The door opened again, and another pair of men stumbled out into the night. Their heads were pressed together as they laughed at some private joke. One reached into his pocket for a set of keys, and as he turned toward the parking lot, his face was lit by the glow of a passing car. I should have put the pieces together earlier. The electric razor in the medicine cabinet, when my dad always used a blade. The detour my father made to stop for coffee every day to and from work at Greg's store. The way he had left my mother all those years ago without explanation. The fact that my grandfather had never liked him. I tugged my black cap down lower and yanked up the fleece neck warmer Rain had given me so that I wouldn't be recognized. Panting, Rain delivered another kick to his victim and then let the guy scurry into the night. He straightened, smiled at me, and cocked his head, waiting for me to take the lead. Which is how I realized that even if I'd been totally clueless, Rain had known about my father all along. When I was 6, the boiler in our house exploded at a time that no one was home. I remember asking the insurance adjuster who came to assess the damage what went wrong. He said something about safety valves and corrosion, and then he rocked back on his heels and said that when there's too much steam and a structure is not strong enough to hold it, something like this is bound to happen. For 16 years I'd been building up steam, because I wasn't my dead brother and never would be, because I couldn't keep my parents together, because I wasn't the grandson my grandfather had wanted, because I was too stupid or angry or weird. When I think back on that moment, it's white hot. Grabbing my father by the throat and smacking his forehead against the pavement, wrenching his arm up behind his back and kicking him in the back till he spit out blood, flipping his limp body over and calling him a faggot as I drove my fist into his face again and again, struggling against Rain as he dragged me to safety when the sirens grew louder and blue and red lights flooded the parking lot. The story spread, the way stories do. And as it did, it swelled and morphed. The newest member of the North American Death Squad, namely me, had jumped 6 guys at once. I had a lead pipe in one hand and a knife in the other. I ripped off a guy's ear with my teeth and swallowed the lobe. None of that, of course, was true, but this was. I had beaten my own father up so badly that he was hospitalized and had to be fed through a straw for months. And for that, I became mythic. "We want the other nurse back," I tell Mary or Marie, whatever the charge nurse's name is. "The one who was here last night." She asks the black nurse to leave so that it's just us. I've pushed down my sleeves again, but her eyes still flicker to my forearm.
"I can assure you that Ruth has more than 20 years of experience here," she says.
"I think you and I both know I'm not objecting to her experience," I reply.
"We can't remove a provider from care because of race. It's discriminatory."
"If I asked for a female OB instead of a male one, would that be discriminatory?" Britt asks. "Or a doctor instead of a medical student? You make those allowances all the time."
"That's different," the nurse says.
"How exactly?" I ask. "From what I can tell, you're in a customer service business and I'm the customer. And you do what makes the customer feel comfortable." I stand up and take a deep breath, towering over her, intimidating by design. "I can't imagine how upsetting it would be to all those other moms and dads here if, you know, things got out of control. If instead of this nice, calm conversation we're having, our voices were raised. If the other patients started to think that maybe their rights would be ignored too." The nurse presses her lips together.
"Are you threatening me, Mr. Bauer?"
I don't think that's necessary, I answer. Do you?
There is a hierarchy to hate, and it's different for everyone. Personally, I hate Spics more than I hate Asians. I hate Jews more than that. And at the very top of the chart, I despise blacks. But even more than any of these groups, the people you always hate the most are anti-racist white folks. Because they are turncoats. For a moment, I wait to see whether Marie is one of them. A muscle jumps in her throat.
I'm sure we can find a mutually agreeable solution, she murmurs. I will put a note on Davis's file stating your wishes.
I think that's a good plan, I reply.
When she huffs out of the room, Britt starts to laugh.
Baby, you are something when you're fierce. But you know this means they're going to spit in my jello before they serve it to me.
I reach into the bassinet and lift Davis into my embrace. He is so small he barely stretches the length of my forearm. I'll bring you waffles from home instead, I tell Britt. Then I lower my lips to my son's brow and whisper against his skin. A secret for just us.
And you, I promise, you, I'll protect for the rest of my life.
A couple of years after I became involved in the white power movement, when I was running NADS in Connecticut, my mother's liver finally quit on her. I went back home to settle the estate and sell my grandfather's house. As I was sorting through her belongings, I found the transcripts of my brother's trial. Why she had them, I don't know. She must have gone out of her way to get them at some point. But I sat on the wooden floor of the living room, surrounded by boxes that would go to Goodwill and into the trash dumpster. And I read them. Every page. Much of the testimony was new to me, as if I hadn't lived through every minute of it. I couldn't tell you if I was too young to remember, or if I'd intentionally forgotten. But the evidence focused on the median line of the road and toxicology screens. Not the defendants, but my brother's. It was Tanner's car that had drifted into oncoming traffic because he was high. It was in all the diagrams of the tire skids, the proof of how a man on trial for negligent homicide had done his best to avoid a car that had veered into his lane. How the jury could not say without a doubt that the car accident was solely the defendant's fault. I sat for a long time with the transcript in my lap, reading, rereading. But this is how I see it. If that nigger hadn't been driving that night, my brother wouldn't be dead.
Ruth, in 20 years, I've been fired once by a patient, and it was for 2 hours. She screamed bloody murder and threw a vase of flowers at my head while in the throes of labor. But she hired me back when I brought her drugs. After Marie asks me to step outside, I stand in the hall for a moment, shaking my head. What was that about? Corinne asks, looking up from the chart at the nurse's station. Just a real winner of a dad, I deadpan. Corinne winces. Worse than vasectomy guy? Once I had a patient in labor whose husband had gotten a vasectomy 2 days before. Every time my patient complained about pain, he complained too. At one point, he called me into the bathroom and pulled down his pants to show me his inflamed scrotum. As my patient huffed and puffed, I told him he should call the doctor, she said. But Turk Bauer was not silly and selfish. Based on the way he brandished that Confederate flag tattoo, I'm guessing he's not too fond of people of color. Worse than that. Well, Corinne shrugs. Marie's good at talking people off the ledge. I'm sure she can fix whatever the problem is. Not unless she can make me white, I think. I'm going to run to the cafeteria for 5 minutes. Cover for me? If you bring me Twizzlers, Corinne says. In the cafeteria, I stand for several minutes in front of the coffee bar, thinking about the tattoo on Turk Bauer's arm. I don't have a problem with white people. I live in a white community. I have white friends. I send my son to a predominantly white school. I treat them the way I want to be treated, based on their individual merits as human beings, not on their skin tone. But then again, the white people I work with and eat lunch with and who teach my son are not overtly prejudiced. I grab Twizzlers for Corinne and a cup of coffee for myself. I carry my cup to the condiment island where there's milk, sugar, Splenda. There's an elderly woman fussing with the top of the cream pitcher, trying to get it open. Her purse sits on the counter. But as I approach, she picks up the handbag and anchors it to her side, crossing an arm over the strap. Oh, that pitcher can be tricky, I say. Can I help? She thanks me and smiles when I hand her back the cream. I'm sure she doesn't even realize she moved her purse when I got closer. But I did. Shake it off, Ruth, I tell myself. I'm not the kind of person who sees the bad in everyone. That's my sister, Adisa. I get on the elevator and head back to my floor. When I arrive, I toss Corinne her Twizzlers and walk toward Brittany Bauer's door. Her chart and little Davis's chart sit outside. I grab the babies to make sure that the pediatrician will be flagged about the potential heart murmur. But when I open the folder, there's a hot pink post-it on the paperwork. No African-American personnel to care for this patient. My face floods with heat. Maria's not at the charge nurse's desk. I start to methodically search through the ward until I find her talking to one of the pediatricians in the nursery. Marie, I say, pasting a smile on my face, do you have a minute? She follows me back toward the nurse's station, but I really don't want to have this conversation in public. Instead, I duck into the break room. Are you kidding me? She doesn't pretend to misunderstand. Ruth, it's nothing. Think of it the way you'd think of a family's religious preferences dictating patient care. You can't possibly be equating this with a religious preference. It's just a formality. The father is a hothead. This just seemed the smoothest way to get him to calm down before he did something extreme. This isn't extreme, I ask. Look, Marie says, if anything, I'm doing you a favor, so you don't have to deal with that guy anymore. Honestly, this isn't about you, Ruth. Really, I say flatly. How many other African-American personnel are on this ward? We both know the answer to that. A big, fat zero. I look her square in the eye. You don't want me to touch that baby? I say. Fine. Done. Then I slam the door behind me so hard that it rattles. Once, religion got tangled up in my care of a newborn. A Muslim couple came into the hospital to have their baby, and the father explained that he had to be the first person to speak to the newborn. When he told me this, I explained that I would do everything I could to honor his request, but that if there were any complications with the birth, my first priority was to make sure that the baby was saved, which required communication, and meant that silence in the delivery room was not likely or possible. I gave the couple some privacy while they discussed this, and finally the father summoned me back. If there are complications, he told me, I hope Allah would understand. As it turned out, his wife had a textbook delivery. Just before the baby was born, I reminded the pediatrician of the patient request, and the doctor stopped calling the arrival of the head, right shoulder, left, like a football play-by-play. The only sound in the room was the baby's cry. I took the newborn, slippery as a minnow, and placed him in a blanket in his father's arms. The man bent close to the tiny head of his son and whispered to him in Arabic. Then he placed the baby into his wife's arms, and the room exploded with noise again. Sometime later that day, when I came to check on my two patients, I found them asleep. The father stood over the bassinet, staring at his child, as if he didn't quite understand how this had happened. It was a look I saw often on the faces of fathers for whom pregnancy wasn't real until this very moment. A mother has 9 months to get used to sharing the space where her heart is. For a father, it comes on sudden, like a storm that changes the landscape forever. What a beautiful boy you have, I said, and he swallowed. There are just some feelings, I've learned, for which we never invented the right words. I hesitated, then asked what had been on my mind since the delivery. If it's not rude of me to ask, would you tell me what you whispered to your son? The Athanm, the father explained. God is great. There is no God but Allah. Muhammad is the messenger of Allah. He looked up at me and smiled. In Islam, we want the first words a child hears to be a prayer. It seemed absolutely fitting, given the miracle that every baby is. The difference between the Muslim father's request and the request made by Turk Bauer was like the difference between day and night, between love and hate. It's a busy afternoon, so I don't have time to talk to Corinne about the new patient she's inherited until we are both pulling on our coats and walking to the elevator. "What was that all about?" Corinne asks. "Marie took me off the case because I'm black," I tell her. Corinne wrinkles her nose. "That doesn't sound like Marie." I turn to her, my hands stilling on the lapels of my coat. "So I'm a liar?" Corinne puts her hand on my arm. "Of course not. I'm just sure there's something else going on." It's wrong to take out my frustration on Corinne, who has to deal with that awful family now. It's wrong for me to be angry at her when I'm really angry at Marie. Corinne, she's always been my partner in crime, not my adversary. But I feel like I could talk till I'm blue in the face and she wouldn't really understand what this feels like. Maybe I should talk till I'm blue in the face. Maybe then I'd be acceptable to the Bowers. "Whatever," I say. "That baby means nothing to me." Corinne tilts her head. "You want to grab a glass of wine before we head home?" I let my shoulders relax. "I can't. Edison's waiting." The elevator dings and the doors open. It's packed because it's the end of a shift. Staring back at me is a sea of blank white faces. Normally I don't even think about that, but suddenly, it's all I can see. I'm tired of being the only black nurse on the birthing pavilion. I'm tired of pretending that doesn't matter. I'm tired. "You know what?" I say to Corinne. "I think I'm going to just take the stairs." When I was 5, I couldn't blend. Although I'd been reading since age 3, the result of my mother's diligent schooling each night when she came home from work, if I came across the word tree, I pronounced it re. Even my last name, Brooks, became Rooks. Mama went to a bookstore and got a book on consonant blends and tutored me for a year. Then she had me tested for a gifted program, and instead of going to school in Harlem, where we lived, my sister and I rode the bus with her for an hour and a half every morning to a public school on the Upper West Side with a mostly Jewish student population. She dropped me off at my classroom door, and then she'd take the subway to work at the Hollowells. My sister Rachel was not the student I was, though, and the bus trip was draining for all of us. So for second grade, we moved back to our old school in Harlem. I spent a year being dulled at all my bright edges, which devastated Mama. When she told her boss, Ms. Mina got me an interview at Dalton. It was the private school her daughter Christina attended, and they were looking for diversity. I received a full scholarship, stayed at the top of my class, received prizes at every assembly, and worked like mad to reward my mama's faith in me. While Rachel made friends with kids in our neighborhood, I knew no one. I didn't really fit in at Dalton, and I definitely didn't fit in at Harlem. As it turned out, I was a straight-A student who still couldn't blend. There were a few students who invited me to their houses, girls who said things like, "You don't talk like you're black," or "I don't think of you that way." Of course, none of those girls ever came to visit me in Harlem. There was always a conflicting dance class, a family commitment, too much homework. Sometimes I imagined them with their silky blonde hair and braces, walking past the check cashier on the corner of the street where I lived. It was like picturing a polar bear in the tropics, and I never let myself think on it long enough to wonder if that's how they saw me at Dalton. When I got into Cornell and many others from my school didn't, I couldn't help but hear the whispers. "It's because she's black." Never mind that I had a 3.87 average, that I'd done well on my SATs. Never mind that I could not afford to go to Cornell and would instead be taking the full ride offered to me by SUNY Plattsburgh. "Baby," my mama said, "it's not easy for a black girl to want. You have to show them you're not a black girl. You're Ruth Brooks." She would squeeze my hand. "You are going to get everything good that's coming to you. Not because you beg for it, and not because of what color you are, because you deserve it. I know I wouldn't have become a nurse if my mama hadn't worked so hard to put me smack in the middle of the path of a good education. I also know that I decided long ago to try to circumvent some of the problems I had when it came to my own child. So when Edison was 2, my husband and I made the choice to move to a white neighborhood with better schools, even though that meant we would be one of the only families of color in the area. We left our apartment near the railroad tracks in New Haven, and after having multiple listings disappear when the realtor found out what we looked like, we finally found a tiny place in the more affluent community of East End. I enrolled Edison in a preschool there so that he started at the same time as all the other kids, and no one could see him as an outsider. He was one of them from the start. When he wanted to have his friends over for a sleepover, no parent could say it was too dangerous an area for their kid to visit. It was, after all, their neighborhood too. And it worked. My, how it worked. It took me advocating for him at first, making sure he had teachers who noticed his intelligence as well as his skin color. But as a result, Edison is in the top 3 of his class. He's a National Merit Scholar. He is going to college and he will be anything he wants to be. I've spent my life making sure of it. When I get home from work, Edison is doing his homework at the kitchen table. "Hey, baby," I say, leaning down to kiss the top of his head. I can only do that now when he's seated. I still remember the moment I realized he was taller than me. How strange it felt to reach my arms up instead of down. To know that someone I'd been supporting his whole life was in a position to support me. He doesn't glance up. "How was work?" I paste a smile on my face. "You know, same old." I shrug off my coat, pick up Edison's jacket from where it's been slung on the back of the couch, and hang them both in the closet. "I'm not running a cleaning service here." "Then leave it where it was," Edison explodes. "Why does everything have to be my fault?" He shoves away from the table so fast he nearly knocks over his chair. Leaving his computer and his open notebook behind, he storms out of the kitchen. I hear the door of his bedroom slam. This is not my boy. My boy is the one who carries groceries up 3 flights of stairs for old Mrs. Laska, without her even having to ask. My boy is the one who always holds open the door for a lady, who says please and thank you, who still keeps in his nightstand every birthday card I've ever written him. Sometimes a new mother turns to me, a shrieking infant in her arms, and asks me how she's supposed to know what her baby needs. In a lot of ways, having a teenager isn't all that different from having a newborn. You learn to read the reactions because they're incapable of saying exactly what it is that's causing pain. So although all I want to do is go into Edison's room and gather him up close and rock him back and forth the way I used to when he was little and hurting, I take a deep breath and go into the kitchen instead. Edison has left me dinner, a plate covered with foil. He can make exactly 3 dishes, macaroni and cheese, fried eggs, and sloppy joes. The rest of the week, he heats up casseroles I make on my days off. Tonight is an enchilada pie, but Edison's also cooked up some peas because I taught him years ago that a plate's not a meal unless there's more than one color on it. I pour myself some wine from a bottle I got from Marie last Christmas. It tastes sour, but I force myself to sip it until I can feel the knots in my shoulders relax, until I can close my eyes and not see Turk Bauer's face. After 10 minutes pass, I knock softly on the door of Edison's room. It's been his since he was 13. I sleep on the pull-out couch in the living room. I turn the knob and find him lying on his bed, his arms behind his head, with his t-shirt stretched over his shoulders and his chin tilted up. I see so much of his daddy in him that for a moment, I feel like I've fallen through time. I sit down beside him on the mattress. "Are we going to talk about it? Or are we going to pretend nothing's wrong?" I ask. Edison's mouth twists. "Do I really get a choice?" "No," I say, smiling a little. "Is this about the calculus test?" He frowns. The calc test? That was no big deal. I got a 96. It's just that I got into it with Bryce today. Bryce has been Edison's closest friend since fifth grade. His mother is a family court judge, and his father is a Yale classics professor. In their living room is a glass case, like the kind you'd find at a museum, housing a bona fide Grecian urn. They've taken Edison on vacation to Gstaad and Santorini. It feels good to have Edison hand me this burden, to wallow in someone else's difficulties for a while. This is what's so upsetting to me about the incident at the hospital. I'm known as the fixer, the one who figures out a solution. I'm not the problem. I'm never the problem. I'm sure it'll blow over, I tell Edison, patting his arm. You two are like brothers. He rolls onto his side and pulls the pillow over his head. Hey, I say, hey. I tug at the pillow and realize that there's one single streak left by a tear darkening the skin of his temple. Baby, I murmur, what happened? I told him I was going to ask Whitney to homecoming. Whitney, I repeat, trying to place the girl from a tangle of Edison's friends. Bryce's sister, he says. I have a brief flash of a girl with strawberry blonde braids I met years ago when picking up Edison from a playdate. The chubby one with braces? Yeah. She doesn't have braces anymore, and she's definitely not chubby. She's got... Edison's eyes soften, and I imagine what my son is seeing. You don't have to finish that sentence, I say quickly. Well, she's amazing. She's a sophomore now. I mean, I've known her forever, but lately when I look at her, it's not just as Bryce's little sister, you know? I had this whole thing planned where one of my buddies would be waiting outside her classroom after each period holding a note. The first note was going to say, Will. The second was going to say, You. Then, Go to, Homecoming, and With. And then, at the end of school, I'd be waiting with the me sign so she'd finally know who was asking. This is a thing now, I interrupt. You don't just ask a girl to the homecoming dance. You have to produce a whole Broadway event to make it happen. What? Mama, that's not the point. The point is that I asked Bryce to be the one who brought her the homecoming note, and he freaked out. I draw in my breath. Well, I say, carefully picking through my words. It's sometimes hard for a guy to see his little sister as anyone's potential girlfriend, no matter how close he is to the person who wants to date her. Edison rolls his eyes. That's not it. Bryce may just need time to get used to the idea. Maybe he was surprised that you'd think of his sister, you know, that way, because you are like family. The problem is, I'm not. My son sits up, his long legs dangling over the edge of the bed. Bryce laughed. He said, Dude, it's one thing for us to hang out, but you and Wit? My parents would shit a brick. His gaze slides away. Sorry about the language. That's okay, baby, I said. Go on. So I asked him why. It didn't make any sense to me. I mean, I've been to Greece with his family. And he said, No offense, but my parents would not be cool with my sister dating a black guy. Like, it's okay to have a black friend who comes on family vacations, but it's not okay for that friend to get involved with your daughter. I have worked so hard to keep Edison from feeling this line being drawn. It never occurred to me that when it happened, which I guess was inevitable, it would burn even more, because he had never seen it coming. I reach for my son's hand and squeeze it. You and Whitney would not be the first couple to find yourselves on opposite sides of a mountain, I say. Romeo and Juliet, Anna Karenina and Vronsky, Maria and Tony, Jack and Rose. Edison looks at me in horror. You do realize that every example you just gave me, at least one of them dies? What I'm trying to say is that if Whitney sees how special you are, she'll want to be with you. And if she doesn't, she's not worth the fight. I put my arm around his shoulders. Edison leans into me. That doesn't make it suck any less. Language, I say automatically. And no, It doesn't. Not for the first time. I wish Wesley were still alive. I wish he hadn't gone back on that second tour of duty in Afghanistan. I wish he hadn't been driving in the convoy when the IED exploded. I wish that he had gotten to know Edison not just as a child, but as a teen and now a young man. I wish he were here to tell his son that when a girl makes your blood rush, it's just the first time of many. I wish he were here, period. If only you could see what we made, I think silently. He's the best of both of us. Whatever happened to Tommy? I ask abruptly. Tommy Phipps? Edison frowns. I think he got busted for dealing heroin behind the school last year. He's in juvie. Do you remember in nursery school when that little delinquent said you looked like burnt toast? A slow smile stretches across Edison's face. Yeah. It was the first time a child had mentioned to Edison that he was different from everyone else in his class, and had done so in a way that also made it seem bad. Burnt. Charred. Ruined. Before that, maybe Edison had noticed. Maybe he hadn't. But that was the first time I had the talk with my son about skin color. You remember what I told you? That my skin was brown because I had more melanin than anyone else in the school. Right. Because everyone knows it's better to have more of something than less. And melanin protects your skin from damage from the sun and helps make your eyesight better. And Tommy Phipps would always be lacking. So actually, you were the lucky one. Slowly, like water on parched pavement, the smile evaporates from Edison's face. I don't feel so lucky now, he says. As little girls, my older sister and I looked nothing alike. Rachel was the color of fresh brewed coffee, just like Mama. Me? I was poured from the same pot, but with so much milk added you couldn't even taste the flavor anymore. The fact that I was lighter got me privileges I didn't understand. Privileges that drove Rachel crazy. Tellers at banks gave me lollipops and then, as an afterthought, offered one to my sister. Teachers called me the pretty Brooks sister, the good Brooks sister. During class portraits, I would be moved to the front row. Rachel got hidden in the back. Rachel told me that my real father was white, that I wasn't really part of our family. Then Rachel and I got into it one day and started yelling at each other, and I said something about going to live with my real daddy. That night, my mama sat me down and showed me pictures of my father, who was also Rachel's father, a man with light brown skin like mine, holding me as a newborn. The date on the photo was a full year before he left all three of us for good. Rachel and I grew up as different as two sisters could be. I'm short, and she's tall as a queen. I was an avid student. She was naturally smarter than I was, but hated school. She embraced what she referred to as her ethnic roots in her 20s, legally changed her name to Adisa, and started wearing her hair in its natural kinky state. Although a lot of ethnic names are Swahili, Adisa comes from the Yoruba language, which she'll tell you is West African, where our ancestors actually came from when they were brought here as slaves. It means one who is clear. See, even her name judges the rest of us for not knowing the truths that she does. Now Adisa lives near the train tracks in New Haven, in a neighborhood where drug deals go down in broad daylight and young men shoot at each other throughout the night. She has 5 kids, and she and the father of her children have minimum wage jobs and barely scrape by. I love my sister to death, but I don't understand the choices she's made any more than she can understand mine. I've wondered, you know, if my drive to become a nurse, to want more, to achieve more for Edison all came from the fact that even between 2 little black sisters, I had a head start. I've wondered if the reason Rachel turned herself into Adisa was because feeding that fire inside herself was exactly what she needed, to believe she had a chance to catch up. On Friday, my day off, I have an appointment at the nail salon with Adisa. We sit side by side, our hands under the UV drying vents. Adisa looks at the bottle of my chosen Opie nail color and shakes her head. I can't believe you picked a polish called juice bar hopping, she says. That's got to be the whitest color ever. It's orange, I point out. I meant the name, Ruth, the name. You ever see a brother in a juice bar? No, because nobody goes to a bar to drink juice, just like nobody asks for a sippy cup full of tequila. I roll my eyes. Really? I just told you all about getting barred from a patient's care, and you want to talk about what color I'm putting on my nails? I'm talking about what color you choose to live your life, girl, Adisa says. What happened to you happens to the rest of us every day, every hour. You're just so used to playing by their rules, you forget you got skin in the game. She smirks. Well, lighter skin, but still. What's that supposed to mean? She shrugs. When was the last time you told someone Mama still works as a domestic? She hardly works now, you know that. She's basically a charity Mina contributes to. You didn't answer my question. I scowl. I don't know when I mentioned it last. Is that the first thing you bring up in conversation? Plus, it doesn't matter what color I am. I'm good at my job. I didn't deserve to be taken off that case. And I don't deserve to be living in Church Street South. But it's going to take more than me to change 200 years of history. My sister likes to play the victim. We've had some pretty heated exchanges about that before. If you don't want to be seen as a stereotype, then the way I see it, don't be one. But to my sister, that means playing a white man's game and being who they want her to be instead of being unapologetically herself. Adisa says the word assimilation with so much venom that you'd think anyone who chooses it, like I did, is swallowing poison. It's also very like my sister to take a problem I have and turn it into her own rant. None of what happened at the hospital is your fault, my sister says, surprising me. I figured she'd say I had this coming to me, because I've been pretending to be someone I'm not, and somewhere along the pretending I forgot the truth. It's their world, Ruth. We just live in it. It's like if you up and move to Japan. You could choose to ignore the customs and never learn the language, but you're gonna get along a lot easier if you do, right? Same thing here. Every time you turn on the TV or the radio, you see and hear about white people going to high school and college, eating dinner and getting engaged and drinking their Pinot Noir. You learn how they live their lives. You speak their language well enough to blend in with them. But how many white people you know who go out of their way to see Tyler Perry movies just so they can learn how to act around black people? That's not the point. No, the point is you can do as the Romans do all you want, but it don't mean the emperor will let you into his palace. White people do not run the world, Adisa, I argue. There are plenty of successful people of color. I name the first three that pop into my head. Colin Powell, Cory Booker, Beyonce. And ain't none of them dark like me, Adisa counters. You know what they say, the deeper you go into the projects, the darker the skin. Clarence Thomas, I pronounce. He's darker than you and he's on the Supreme Court. My sister laughs. Ruth, he's so conservative, he probably bleeds white. My phone dings and I carefully extract it from my purse so I don't mess up my nails. Edison? Adisa asks immediately. Say what you will about her, but she loves my son as much as I do. No, it's Lucille from work. Just seeing her name pop up on my phone makes my mouth go dry. She was the nurse during the delivery of Davis Bauer. But this isn't about that family at all. Lucille's got a stomach bug. She needs someone to fill in for her tonight. She's willing to trade me so that instead of working all day Saturday, I can leave at 11. It means pulling a double shift, but I'm already thinking of what I could do with that time on Saturday. Edison needs a new winter coat this year. I swear he's grown 4 inches over the summer. I could treat him to lunch after shopping. Maybe there's even a movie coming out that Edison and I could go see. It's been hitting me hard lately. The realization that getting my son to a point where he's accepted to college also means that I will be left alone. They want me to come into work tonight. Who's they? The Nazis? No. Another nurse who's sick. Another white nurse, Adisa clarifies. I don't even respond. Adisa leans back in her chair. Seems to me they're not in a position to be asking you for favors. I'm about to defend Lucille, who had absolutely nothing to do with Marie's decision to put a post-it note on the baby's file, when the nail technician interrupts us, checking our fingers to see if the polish is dry. Okay, she says. All done. Adisa waggles her fingers, a shocking shade of hot pink. Why do we keep coming here? I hate this salon, she says, her voice low. They don't look me in the eye. They won't put my change right in my hand. It's like they think my black is gonna rub off on them. They're Korean, I point out. Did you ever think that maybe in their culture, neither of those things are polite? Adisa raises a brow. All right, Ruth, she says. You just keep telling yourself it's not about you. Not 10 minutes into my unscheduled shift, I'm already sorry I said yes. There's a storm crackling outside. One of the weathermen didn't see it coming, and the barometric pressure's tanked, which leads to early ruptured membranes, to women going into premature labor, to patients who are writhing in the halls because we don't have enough space for them. I'm running around like a chicken with its head cut off, which is a good thing because it keeps me from thinking about Turk and Brittany Bauer and their baby. But not so much that I don't casually check the chart when I first come on duty. I tell myself that I just want to make sure someone white, has scheduled the consult with the pediatric cardiologist before the baby is discharged. And yes, there it is in the schedule. Along with a record of Corinne doing the baby's heel stick on Friday afternoon to draw blood for the state newborn screening. But then someone calls my name and I find myself being pulled into the orbit of a laboring woman who's being wheeled up from emergency. Her partner looks terrified, the kind of man who is used to being able to fix things, who has come to the sudden realization that this is outside his wheelhouse. I'm Ruth, I say to the woman, who seems to have telescoped further into herself with each subsequent contraction. I'm going to be here with you the whole time. Her name is Eliza, and her contractions are 4 minutes apart, according to her husband, George. This is their first pregnancy. I get my patient settled in the last birthing room we have available and take a urine sample, then hook her up to the monitor, scanning the gravestone printout. I grab her vitals and start asking questions. How strong are the contractions? Where are you feeling them? The front or the back? Are you leaking any fluid? Are you bleeding? How's the baby moving? If you're ready, Eliza, I say, I'm going to check your cervix. I put on a pair of gloves and move to the foot of the bed, touch her knee. An expression flickers across her face that gives me pause. Now, most laboring women will do anything to get that baby out of them. There's fear about getting through childbirth, yes, but that's different from fear of being touched. And that's what I'm reading all over Eliza's face. A dozen questions jockey their way to the tip of my tongue. Eliza changed in the bathroom with her husband's help, so I didn't see if she had any bruises that might flag an abusive relationship. I glance at George. He looks like an ordinary father-to-be, nervous, out of place, not like a guy with anger management issues. Then again, Turk Bauer looked pretty normal to me until he rolled up his sleeves. Shaking my head to clear it, I turn to George and pin a smile over my instincts. Would you mind going to the kitchenette and getting some ice chips for Eliza, I say? It'd be a tremendous help. Never mind, that's a nurse's job. George looks supremely relieved to be given a task. The minute he's out of the room, I turn to Eliza. Is everything all right? I ask, looking her in the eye. Is there something you need to tell me that you couldn't say with George in the room? She shakes her head and then bursts into tears. I strip off my gloves. The cervical exam can wait, and reach for her hand. Eliza, you can talk to me. The reason I got pregnant is because I was raped, she sobs. George doesn't even know it happened. He's so happy about this baby. I couldn't tell him it might not be his. The story comes out, whispered in the middle of the night, when Eliza has stalled at 7 centimeters dilated, and George has gone to get a snack from the cafeteria. Labor is like that, a shared trauma bond, an accelerant that makes relationships stronger. And so even though I am little more than a stranger to Eliza, she pours out her soul to me as if she has fallen overboard and I am the only glimpse of land on the horizon. She was on a business trip, celebrating the close of a deal with an important, elusive client. The client invited her out to dinner with some others and bought her a drink. And the next thing Eliza remembered was waking up in his hotel room and feeling sore all over. When she finishes, we both sit, letting the words settle. I couldn't tell George, Eliza says, her hands bunched on the rough hospital linens. He would have gone to my boss, and believe me, they wouldn't